Over the last few years, the spread of weapons of mass destruction, nuclear, chemical, biological, has grown to be a major worry in the world today, and for good reason. However, if you ask this question, what's responsible for most of the civilian casualties in modern conflicts, it turns out it's certainly not weapons of mass destruction. It is ordinary conventional weapons, things like rifles and landmines and grenades. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the global trade in small arms and some of the efforts that are being made to restrain that trade. And our guest with the program is Matthew Schroeder. He is manager of the Arms Sales Monitoring Project, which is a project of the Federation of American Scientists. Since joining the Federation in February of 2002, our guest, Matthew Schroeder, has researched and written on U.S. arms transfers and arms export policies. He's contributed articles to various publications, including the Baltimore Sun, Defense News, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientist. He also served as chair of the Arms Transfers Working Group, an alliance of arms control, human rights, and religious groups based in Washington, D.C. Just a word about the Federation of American Scientists, by the way. This is an organization that's been around for quite a long time. It was founded in 1945, at that time called the Federation of Atomic Scientists. The founders of the group were all members of the Manhattan Project, who were very concerned about the threat posed to the world by nuclear weapons, and since that time have been working on that issue and also weapons issues of all kinds. And if you're interested in finding out more about the Federation of American Scientists and you have access to the Internet, they do have a website, which is www.fas.org. So you can check that out. And there you will also find information about the program that our guest is involved with, you can go there and find all about it. Of course, here this morning on the program, questions and comments are welcome, just like always. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, so people are welcome to call. And we do also have that toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call, you may use that number and calls on us, and that is 800-222-9455. So, again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Anybody's welcome to call. The only thing we ask is that people just try to be brief so that we can get in as many callers as possible and keep the program moving along. Mr. Schroeder, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Certainly appreciate it. Can you give us some numbers that would give some sense of what the scope of the small arms trade in the world is in terms of how much money, perhaps, or how many weapons we're talking about, both the legal trade and the illegal trade?
Sure. In terms of numbers, there's an estimated 639 million small arms and light weapons in the world today, it's when you're talking about the illicit trade, it's very murky, very opaque, so I'm hesitant to assign any numbers to that. The global trade in dollar value terms is about $4 billion, and there have been some analysts who have estimated that 10 to 20% of that is illicit, which would be about $400 to $800 million a year. But again, I would add the caveat that because it's illicit and because it's so difficult to track these types of weapons, that those are rough estimates of the scope of the trade.
And there, I guess when we talk about the illicit trade, I suppose this could take many forms, all of the way from the person who has the weapons and sells them to a guerrilla group, an insurgent group, a criminal organization, could also be a militia, could be a military of another country, and perhaps knowingly does that. Everything from that to someone who has the weapons, sells them to another party, thinking that that person is one thing, and it turns out that they're something else, so that they may have thought that that was a legitimate sale and it was going to a legitimate purpose, to an army, to a police organization, something like that. And when it turns out, in fact, that that person is buying them and selling them, passing them on to, could be a terrorist organization.
Exactly. The latter is what we refer to as a gray market transfer, in which the mechanisms for the transfer are legal or are licit, part of an established legal procedure that the states undertake to transfer weapons. And oftentimes, a broker will approach a state with a forged end user certificate or some other documentation indicating that the recipient is someone other than their actual intended recipient. They'll acquire the weapons, and then the weapons will debark from the origin country and take a beeline to the actual recipient, which can be a terrorist organization, could be international criminals, could be an embargoed country. That's not uncommon as well.
Hmm. In terms of the nations of the world that are the biggest manufacturers of small arms, what are the biggest manufacturers, and are there some that stand far and away out? I'm sure that a lot of nations do produce their own small arms or produce them for export. But if you take a look at those countries that produce weapons in very, very large numbers, what are they?
I don't have that data at my fingertips right now. I know that the United States is a large producer. A lot of the former Soviet Union countries are. Brazil in this hemisphere is a large producer or a medium-sized producer. But they're by no means the only producers. There are close to 100 countries with the capacity to produce, with the manufacturing capacity to produce small arms and light weapons. And more frightening is the capacity of non-state or small craft producers is what they're called, which can be terrorist organizations even that have the capacity to produce their own small arms. And you see small craft workshops in near the Afghan border in Pakistan, in which they can turn out one or two rifles that are very close, at least in appearance, to those produced by legitimate manufacturers in places like the former Soviet Union. And one particularly harrowing recent example that I've heard of, and this the details are still being fleshed out, but an initial study done by Viva Rio revealed that the Colombian terrorists, the FARC, which is the acronym abbreviation of that particular organization, has imported industrial machinery and has bribed members of the military and of the state arms manufacturer to come and work in these craft production workshops and turn out, high-quality 9mm machine guns, for example, and, silencers for pistols, components for rifles, et cetera. That adds another dimension, another, complex and difficult dimension to the problem.
Well, as you say, that's what makes it so difficult is that we're not talking about a very high level of technological sophistication that's necessary to produce weapons like these.
Right.
That you could indeed set up it would be easy to set up a workshop, and I'm sure there are places where if you brought them an AK-47 and you said, here, can you make me some more of these, they would be able to do it for you.
Right. And when we talk about small arms and light weapons, it's probably important to define our terms.
Mm-hmm.
Small arms, there's no consensus on the definition, but a small arm is normally what we think of as a firearm, a pistol, assault rifle, shotgun, etc. And then a light weapon is a weapon that can be effectively handled by one or two people, shoulder-fired anti-tank missiles, shoulder-fired anti-aircraft missiles. And the reason that I bring this up now is because there's a significant difference in the difficulty of manufacturing a pistol, for example, and a shoulder-fired surface-to-air missile, which is important in determining the policy means of addressing the problem. With shoulder-fired surface-to-air missiles, for example, so-called MANPADs, probably around 20 countries that have the capacity to produce these weapons, and so it's much easier, and you're not going to have illicit production of MANPADs. The sensitivity or the technology is just too complex, and it's a much easier, it's a problem that's easier to get your hands around than the illicit manufacture or transfer of pistols and more simple weapons. That said, it's not easy. It's just easier.
Mm-hmm. Now, does this do you also include landmines, or is that a separate issue? And here, what we're talking about essentially is some kind of a weapon that a person could pick up and carry around with them.
Well, no, a landmine is often included, but the landmine is kind of a separate category of weapon because with the Ottawa process, in which a large number of countries have agreed to stop producing, exporting, stockpiling, and selling landmines, it's basically a proscribed weapon now, or it's moving towards that status in which it's losing its place in military doctrine and in terms of legitimacy in the eyes of the international community. That's very different from firearms. There is no replacement for firearms for civilian law enforcement and in military doctrine. You still need to you need to produce, and to some degree you need to transfer firearms. With landmines, from what I understand, I'm not a technical expert in this, there are alternatives, and the world is increasingly demanding that militaries find alternatives to these weapons.
Let me again very quickly introduce the guest for this hour of Focus 580. We're talking with Matthew Schroeder. He is the manager of the Arms Sales Monitoring Project of the Federation of American Scientists. And we are talking about the international trade in small arms, and defined as he has, to include things like pistols and rifles, but also somewhat more sophisticated devices like shoulder-fired surface-to-air missiles. I'm sure we also include things like rocket-propelled grenades.
Exactly.
And so forth. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. We have programs. The United States has programs and has for a while now, designed, for example, to help Russia and countries that had been part of the Soviet Union to secure and destroy nuclear weapons. And they have apparently been successful, although I think some people feel that we haven't put the resources into these programs that we should. And those programs exist, and there have been some success. We do also have, apparently, there are many countries that have stockpiles of the kind of weapons that we're here talking about, conventional light weapons that either they don't need or they don't want. And we do also have a program, as I understand it, there is a program that has been set up by the State Department to try to help countries destroy these things, conventional arms. And that has worked, although, again, some people have argued that we certainly could be putting more resources into it than we are. Can you talk about what sort of efforts exist to try to reduce stockpiles of these light conventional weapons?
Yeah, the State Department, for several years now, the State Department has operated what I consider one of the more exciting and effective programs, disarmament or arms control programs out there. It's their Small Arms and Light Weapons Destruction Program. What they do is, when they're approached by countries to help them to destroy surplus stockpiles, they find the funding and they help with technical cooperation to go in and eliminate these stockpiles. And to date, they've destroyed, I think the latest number is around 700,000 surplus small arms light weapons and tens of millions of rounds of ammunition. And included in that number is 10,500 shoulder-fired surface-to-air missiles. And they're doing it on a shoestring. For several years at the beginning of the program, Congress was appropriating $2 million, $3 million a year. Last year, that number jumped up to I think, close to $7 million. And the president, in his budget this year, requested close to $9 million. But we're still talking, that's a rounding error in most Department of Defense budget items. And so if you're talking about bang for the buck in terms of security, you don't get any more than the State Department Small Arms Light Weapons Destruction Program.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller here to talk with. Let's do that. Someone listening this morning in Chicago on our line number 4, the toll-free line. Hello. Hold on a second. Now, go ahead.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Yes,
sir. Yes.
Okay. I know that they're concerned about North Korea's nuclear program. How active are they in the small arms sales?
That's a good question. I'm not sure about. I don't have any data at my fingertips on North Korea per se, but we do know that they're a producer of the shoulder-fired surface-to-air missiles, and I can't imagine that they're not a producer of other types of small arms light weapons. And the North Koreans are pretty much inaccountable to the international community on arms control issues. So that's a problem. I'm sure that that's something to be concerned about.
Yeah, I know. That when Vietnam fell, that they got literally thousands of American weapons, and they used those later in Cambodia and war against China. But I know that North Korea, now that they probably have nuclear weapons, or at least they're supposed to have 6 to 8 or something like that, not only are they concerned about maybe China or North Korea, they rather might sell 2 or 3 of these to, say, Al-Qaeda, but I just wondered how active they were in the other arms markets.
Yeah, that's a good question. Unfortunately, I don't have a ready answer, but I would imagine that that is a concern. That is certainly a concern.
Yeah. Well, certainly we don't want to see any trouble. If a war broke out over there, it would be terrible, not only for us, but for them. And
yeah, unacceptable.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
All right. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. We're talking a moment ago about the fact that the United States does have this program, and it's run by the State Department, to help countries that have stockpiles of weapons, conventional small arms, light weapons, that they don't need, that they don't want, helping them to destroy those. How much of a problem, however, is stockpiles that countries may be having that they are storing, that they think are stored securely, but are not, and we end up weapons like that end up on the black market and end up being sold out the back door, for example.
Oh, that's a big problem. The area that I've researched most thoroughly is Latin America and Colombia in particular, and you see several. You see a couple examples of what we call bulk transfers, and that's when instead of one or two or a dozen weapons smuggled across the border at a time, you see the infusion of thousands of weapons in a single shipment, and those in one particular case in Nicaragua, that's because they just didn't have the control over. They didn't have the controls in place to stop the transfer before it took place. And I'm thinking, in particular, of a transfer from a couple years ago in which an Israeli broker operating out of Pennsylvania convinced the Nicaraguan military that the Panamanian National Police wanted to take 3,000 of its excess AK series assault rifles off of its hands. They provided documentation that was forged, and the Nicaraguans accepted it, gave them the weapons. The Israelis arranged for the transfer of the weapons, but not to Panama, to Turbo, Colombia, where the paramilitaries, the AUC, the United Defense Forces of Colombia, took possession of them. The AUC is an organization that's on the America's list of terrorist organizations. What's interesting about that is the Organization of American States did an in-depth study of this particular transfer and determined that the Panamanians had no knowledge of this transfer. So all the Nicaraguans would have had to do is pick up the phone and call their counterparts in Panama, and they would have discovered right away that this was an attempted diversion. They could have scuttled the deal right away. They didn't do that. And suddenly you've got 3,000 more deadly weapons in the hands of a group that, some human rights organizations estimate is responsible for 70% of the human rights violations in Colombia. So that's an example of how states with large surpluses that don't eliminate those surpluses or don't eliminate them quickly enough and don't strengthen their export controls adequately enough are a problem. in this regard.
Well, that's an example of one of the cases that we talked a little bit about in general at the beginning, where you have someone who is an arms dealer or arms trader who comes to you, and maybe you are a country and you have the stockpile, you have the weapons available, you don't need them, and they say, well, I'll be happy to take those off your hands, and I'm going to sell them to the Defense Forces of Panama, and you, Nicaragua, say, well, okay, that sounds fine to us. And in fact, that person is misrepresenting what it was they're going to do with those weapons, and they end up in somebody else's hands.
Exactly.
And that it sounds as if that's a thing, that's the kind of thing that happens fairly often around the world.
Well, in terms of Colombia, that's kind of rare. I mean, those that have come to light, it's usually, there was a study done by the RAND, and they determined that the bulk of the transfers are smaller, what they call antrade transfers, in which you have, you know, you have small-time operators that are transferring, you know, 6, 12, 18 rifles or whatever across the border in such ways as in pickup trucks that are loaded with produce, you know. It's not uncommon for, you know, Colombian authorities to pull over a pickup truck with, you know, sacks of vegetables, look under the vegetables, and find some, you know, assault rifles in the back. And then also, there's so many different ways that terrorist organizations like the FARC acquire these weapons that to put too much emphasis on any one mean or one source can be a mistake, because you need to address all the sources simultaneously and with equal vigor.
Well, this does also point to one of the realities of the small arms trade, and that is that these weapons are durable and they can stay around and continue to function for a long time and be passed from one person to another. And there might indeed, you might have a case where at one time a government would have decided that they actually need them, and then later that they don't. And yet they continue to be functional and can be a commodity and continue to be used and continue to be passed from one party to another. So once we have weapons that have been around for a long time, we have new weapons all the time that are being produced, so that the total pool of them continues to grow. And it's a very, very tradable and very saleable commodity.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, questions are certainly welcome. Again, our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Matthew Schroeder. He is the manager of the Arms Sales Monitoring Project, and this is a project of the Federation of American Scientists. He's written on U.S. arms transfers and arms export policies now for several years. Since joining the Federation, he's written articles that have appeared in Baltimore Sun, Defense News, Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, other publications. He also served as chair of the Arms Transfers Working Group, which is an alliance of arms control, human rights, and religious groups based in Washington, D.C. And we are talking about the international trade in small arms. Questions, again, are welcome. We have someone here ready to go. We will get right to. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. And we do have a caller here next in Urbana on our line one. Hello.
Hello. We know that the United States and Russia and I believe China are all major suppliers of weapons. Among the smaller countries, I believe North Korea is reputed to be. You mentioned Israel. How important are they in arms deals?
In general, Israel is a growing supplier of arms deals, and they make the headlines for the more sophisticated weaponry, such as the equivalent of the Patriot missile that they're contemplating selling to India. And the aborted sale 4 or 5 years ago of their equivalent of the airborne early warning control system that, you know, sailed to China that was scuttled. In terms of small arms light weapons, I don't have any data on them per se. Israeli brokers are occasionally implicated in transfers abroad, but I don't know. And you'll often find Israel origin small arms light weapons like Uzis in conflict zones, but I don't have any data on or any extensive knowledge on illicit transfers from Israeli sources, per se.
I suppose it's important to make the distinction between governmental transfers and...
I'm sorry, I can hardly hear you.
I'm having a little trouble with my voice this morning.
Okay.
I suppose it's important to make a distinction between governmental transfers and private individuals, arms dealers who are not affiliated with the government.
Yes, it is in one aspect, but in another it's not. The U.S. Controls both government-to-government transfers, requires authorizations for them and for private individuals that are selling weapons abroad. They require a license for each and every sale of firearms, regardless of how small, with a few exceptions. But generally speaking, they require an individual license in which a trained licensing officer will sit down with that license, take a look at it, look for any signs of a potential diversion, and, you know, authorize it or turn it down. That's very important. The distinction is relevant in academic terms and for analysis, but in terms of control, there should be very little difference. The controls on commercial sales should be equally, if not more, rigorous than the controls on government-to-government sales.
I wonder, is there any legitimate reason for non-governmental transfers of weapons? It seems to me that this is an area where the supply-side economists have a legitimate claim that the supply drives the trade and perhaps even drives the number of armed conflicts in the world.
Well, that's a tricky issue. It's easy to blame the suppliers, but... It's never that simple. What you've got to ultimately, the only way to really minimize this problem is to get in there and address demand. Until you get into the Democratic Republic of Congo's, the other war zones of the world, and really sort things out and provide some stability and safety, you're going to have a demand for small arms and light weapons, and that demand will be filled. So attacking the major supplier, or not attacking, but, you know, focusing all your energy on the major suppliers is not a complete approach, because you've got 95 other countries that may be willing to fill that void, and then you've got hundreds of millions of weapons in circulation in the black market that are going to gravitate towards those conflict zones, because that's often where the black market prices are highest for those.
Well, thank you. I guess I'll let someone else.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Again, others who are listening, if you have questions, comments, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, picking up on some of the comments there the caller was making, and going back to the point that we made a little bit earlier about one of the realities about the weapons that we're talking about is that they can continue to be functional for a long time. They're durable. They hang around. Is that if you have a place where there was a conflict, and say that somehow you have managed to settle the conflict or at least gotten a ceasefire, there can still be a lot of weapons around, and they can be very dangerous and destabilizing because they can help precipitate an outbreak of conflict again. They can be used by people to commit crimes. They can be used by people who are interested in disrupting reconstruction after a conflict. So that's suggests why it is that what some people have called micro disarmament is a very important part of the rebuilding that has to go on after conflicts end, or at least after hostilities end. Is that in peacekeeping, has that now become an important feature? That is, if you go into a place, you do whatever you can to try to secure the arms that are around?
There's a growing recognition of the importance of that. It's still often done inadequately, according to experts who have studied this. But I think that is very, very important. Proper disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration of former combatants is essential to preventing the type of skyrocketing crime rates and return to armed conflict that are always a danger in post-conflict situations. And the one aspect of that is the so-called buyback program, and that's very tricky because in situations that are very unstable and oftentimes lawless. What'll happen is if you offer a cash incentive, people will come forward with weapons, but they're worse weapons. They're outdated. They're not functioning properly. They're least effective weapons. They'll get the cash for the weapons, and then they'll go out and they'll buy another weapon, a better weapon. You know, because if you're sponging up the weapons in a given region is only so effective if there's an opportunity to bring in new weapons. So one of the trends is to go to more community focused buyback programs in which communities are provided with essentials, such as some type of development incentive for turning in small arms and light weapons. Even that's problematic, though, because you want to provide those services anyway. You don't want to condition them on the meeting of certain demands. So it's very tricky, very complex, and there are no easy solutions.
We talked a little bit ago about the fact that perhaps the ultimate solution to the problem lies in dealing with the demand, not so much with the supply. But having said that, what sort of international regulations exist that govern the export of small arms?
There are no legally binding or even really universal politically binding rules on arms transfers. There are regional bodies that have set up conventions and other forms of agreements that attempt to standardize and universalize some of these practices, some of the best practices in terms of control. And there's an international instrument that's part of the UN Transnational Crime Convention that attempts to do the same thing. But right now, it's really up to the states, the individual countries, to determine how rigorous their controls are. And some of the most effective ways of addressing that is for an influential country like the United States to go in and exert bilateral pressure on a country to clean up their act when it comes to this. Short answer is there really aren't any universal standards for arms exports.
Hmm. There has been now, at least I know for the past few years, an effort at the United Nations to try to develop some kind of international convention that would deal with the illegal transactions in small arms. And it's been controversial in part because of the United States seems not interested or not willing to support it. The last time that this was really being in the news, I think, was in the summer of 2001 when it was being discussed at the United Nations. And a representative of the administration, and interestingly enough, it happened to be John Bolton, sat there at this conference and in very strong terms said that the United States believed that firearm ownership was an important right and certainly wouldn't want to do anything that would curtail the right of Americans to have guns, and made it sound as if the administration thought that everybody had that right and that they were extremely cool to the idea of having any kind of international agreement. Now, I know that this issue is scheduled again to be discussed at the UN, I think, this year. And I think that there's also something scheduled for next year, and there's this hope that maybe some kind of international agreement can be reached, but it doesn't sound as if the United States is particularly interested in being a party to it.
Not exactly. The United States is very, very, it's one of the leaders in certain aspects of efforts to control this problem, and has some of the best laws and regulations on the books and some of the most effective control mechanisms for export. There are two difficulties here, or two kind of hot-button issues for the United States. One is domestic gun control, which is really a non-starter. And if you propose an agreement that requires domestic gun control, you're not going to get very far with the United States. The other is transfers to non-state actors. The United States wants to reserve the right to transfer arms to non-state actors. The United States is very willing and has and continues to work with other countries in international fora to develop you know, best practices and standards for brokering, for marking and tracing, for, you know, arms export controls. It's one of the leading contributors to small arms, light weapons destruction, and strengthening national export controls. So I think it's too simplistic to say that the United States is obstructionist on this issue. If you cross red lines, the United States will, you know, is one of the more adamant and just one of the more difficult countries to persuade in terms of those two issues. But in other ways, the United States is leading the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad you put the finer point on it, so you can see just how complicated the issue is. I guess for myself, whether or not one may think that guns are a problem in the United States, it seems to me, though, that clearly that issue, gun ownership in this country and whether or not it caused problems, and the trade and the international trade in small arms, particularly the illegal trade, it seems to me that those are two rather different issues. And I'm not exactly sure that I see why it is that that American attitudes toward gun ownership should have much influence on whether or not the U.S. takes a position on this problem internationally or not.
The two intersect when policies proposed at the international level would impinge upon or are perceived to impinge upon domestic gun ownership in the United States. And, you know, with, you know, not, there are cases to be made that, you know, you need to regulate effectively the domestic gun ownership. I'm not making that case. Let me make that clear. I think you can deal with the two very distinctly and very separately, and that's what we do. We focus on international transfers and export controls. We don't focus on domestic gun control at all. But it's a very difficult issue, and, you know, there are many opportunities for the two to become entwined. And when countries push the point too hard, you know, they jeopardize, coming to international consensus in other areas. That can have, you know, very significant and beneficial effects on the illicit interstate trade of small arms and light weapons.
And I suppose, to be fair, it should be said that there are other countries that have their own reasons to be hesitant to become involved in this as an international issue, and China and Russia are among them. So it's perhaps not just the United States.
No, not at all. Not at all. Not in the slightest. Hmm.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Perhaps I should introduce once again our guest for this hour, Matthew Schroeder. He's manager of the Arms Sales Monitoring Project of the Federation of American Scientists. And he has now, since joining the Federation in February of 2002, has researched and written on U.S. arms transfers and arms export policies. And questions are welcome here. We're talking about the issue of the small arms trade around the world. And here, really, what we're talking about is conventional light arms, small arms, light weapons. It can be rifles, pistols, grenades, rocket-propelled grenades, could even be something as sophisticated as a shoulder-fired surface-to-air missile, and the problem of the circulating of these weapons around the world. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. I think in the past, one of the concerns that has been voiced by people is the extent to which countries, developing countries, are spending significant amounts of money on weaponry and defend themselves. And you'd have to say that indeed they have that right to have some defense. But in places where the standard of living for citizens is undesirably low, you have to ask questions about the government's priorities if they're spending a lot of their money on armaments, to the exclusion of other kinds of infrastructure developments that would benefit their people. Is that the kind of issue that concerns you?
That gets into an entirely different field that requires, you know, extensive knowledge of economics and other issues that I do not have expertise in. So I haven't focused on that in depth But that's very, very difficult, because while we may, you know, argue that, you know, the purchase of $100 million jet fighter aircraft to a country that whose neighbors have no, you know, real capacity to invade them, to stage a cross-border invasion, is mistaken. I think you're absolutely right. The concept of sovereignty is still very important, and you know, every country has a right to protect its borders and for legitimate internal defense.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I suppose I'm raising a different sort of an issue, particularly if we're talking about something like as technologically sophisticated as a jet fighter. The issue there is very, very different from those that really was the main focus of what we were talking about here, particularly when we're talking about things can be relatively easily manufactured, things like assault rifles. So, you know, perhaps it's a separate sort of issue.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, there's a gamut of issues associated with what we call big weapon transfers. There's small mm-hmm. weapons and then big weapons or large weapons. And that comes with its own set of challenges and difficulties.
Well, what I mentioned the fact that now, on and off over the last few years, there has been some discussion in the United Nations about some kind of international agreement that would help to limit this international trade in small arms. What are people thinking about?
Well, there's the Program of Action is a politically binding document that really is it contains best practices at every it contains prescriptions at every level, but it's not legally binding, and I don't know that there's any particular drive to make it legally binding. There is there's a parallel effort to enact an arms trade treaty, and you may have recently heard about that from the British government that is starting to champion this issue. And what this would be is a legally, well, to be determined, but I think some of the proponents want it to be a legally binding treaty that would limit or ban the transfer of all weapons to egregious abuses of human rights, to countries that are involved in or could commit genocide, to countries that in you know, unstable regions in which, you know, the arms transfer could have a destabilizing effect, to countries where there's a problem of diversion. So this is a parallel effort to those that to the Program of Action and the other conventions that are out there to try to get to provide some type of structure and universality to the controls on the transfer of small arms and light weapons.
Hmm. Is there really? I guess here we're in a way here we're talking about two different. We have talked about two different kinds of problems. One is the states that are purchasing weapons and non-state actors that are interested in purchasing weapons. And there, it's probably more the case that one is more likely to be a legal purchase and the other not. And certainly, you can make the argument that in some cases, states. Governments that buy weapons end up using them against internal opposition, and that's problematic. But that it seems that's going to be a much more difficult thing to get at than trying to keep weapons out of the hands of insurgent groups or guerrilla groups or terrorist groups.
Yeah, I mean both have their challenges, and both. Both sets of problems have you know their distinct challenges. It's easier to cut off. I mean, at an official level, for example, it's easier to cut off an abusive government in terms of the United States, at least, than it is to you know cut the flow of arms to a non-state actor, you know, which is getting them on the black market anyway. Governments require, you know, they standardize their weapons. They require many more. They require, you know, constant sources of ammunition and spare parts, et cetera. So at one level, it's easier. On another level, it can be just as complex and vexing, you know. A government that is involved in a civil war, for example, that's trying to suppress an insurgency, is also it's not uncommon for them to abuse human rights. And so what do you do in a case like that? Do you cut off the flow of weapons to them make them less capable of prosecuting their war against insurgents, which, you know, can have its own disastrous outcomes depending on, you know, the goals of the insurgents, the type of insurgency, et cetera, the nature of the insurgent themselves. When there's a collapse of state power, that's when people suffer the most oftentimes. That is a very tricky issue as well, but it's tricky for other reasons.
Hmm. Back at the beginning of the program, as I was just kind of introducing the topic, noting the fact that there has been, and rightly so, in recent years, there's been growing concern about the issue of weapons of mass destruction, and noted that here we have an issue that's sort of parallel. And if you look at the numbers of civilians around the world in conflicts, and particularly in those places that we euphemistically call low intensity, the people who have been killed by small arms, conventional small arms, we're getting up to the levels of weapons of mass destruction. But it seems that this is an issue, though, that just doesn't quite get the same level of attention that it does when you start talking about biological, chemical, nuclear weapons.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is really fascinating, because if you look at the statistics, a few years ago, there were estimates that 500,000 people were dying as a result of misuse of small arms and light weapons every year, 300,000 in conflict zones and 200,000 as a result of homicides and suicides in non-conflict areas. 500,000 people, 500,000 people. That is, I've seen theoretical estimates of, you know, highly successful aerosolized anthrax attacks on major cities that have put that as the theoretical number of casualties as a result of that. But how many successful aerosolized anthrax attacks have we had on major cities? None. You know, and if you look at the statistics on deaths from the so-called weapons of mass destruction versus deaths from, you know, terrorist incidents involving small arms, light weapons, and explosives, there's no comparison. And even the term WMD is problematic, and this is a bit tangential, but I think it's important. There are certain weapons that clearly fit into this category. Nuclear weapons, for example. You have a nuclear explosion in a populated area. Tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, possibly millions of people will die. Chemical weapons, very different. You know, you can have a shell full of mustard gas and shoot it into an area, and it may kill just as many people as a conventional shell. But that's considered a weapon of mass destruction because it's a chemical weapon. So it's WMD is kind of a flawed term, I think, in that case. And even now, it's being applied to they're starting to call small arms light weapons of mass destruction in slow motion. In one way, that's true. In another way, that makes that term meaningless. So it's probably better just to start to refer to NBC, nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons, and then conventional weapons, because it's more useful, I think.
Mm. Well, going back to the question about why it is that this particular, that is, proliferation of conventional arms, particularly conventional small arms, why it is that it doesn't seem to get more attention or doesn't catch people's attention. And maybe it is the sad fact that if 100 people are killed all at one time, that gets our attention. But if 100 people are killed one or two every day, then somehow that doesn't.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting question. And also, if you look at other than, you know, gun violence in cities, you know, in the United States, the conflict deaths associated with rocket-propelled grenades, with, you know, anti-tank weapons, with assault rifles and machine guns, most of that is in third world countries. Most of that is not in the developing world. I mean, in the developed world. And so, you know, but, you know, the United States, among other countries, is a primary target for, you know, an NBC attack, for example. And so it's in the utmost of the minds of policymakers that, you know, and also the ramifications of a successful terrorist attack using nuclear weapons would be unimaginable. In some ways, you could argue that our society would be very different after such an attack. So it's understandable at one level. But these are not mutually exclusive either. You can devote resources and time and attention to addressing the threat of conventional weapons at the same time that you devote them to mitigating the risk from nuclear weapons. And I think there's the issue of manpads has really thrust the issue of conventional small arms and light weapons proliferation closer to the forefront of, at least in the American policy arena. You're seeing talk of a multi-billion-dollar program now by the Department of Homeland Security to equip every commercial aircraft, all 6,800 commercial jet airliners, with infrared countermeasures to counter these weapons. That's really unprecedented in terms of conventional addressing the threat of small arms light weapons. So as the threat of manpads, which is also very scary and could be very,
You better define what that is.
Oh, I'm sorry. Man-portable air defense systems.
Okay.
Shoulder-fired
right.
surface-to-air missiles.
Right.
Stingers. So as that has started to gain traction momentum, my prediction is that other programs that address small arms and light weapons destruction more broadly are going to attract increased attention by policymakers.
Well, there we must stop because we've come to the end of the time. And I want to thank our guest very much, Matt Schroeder. He is manager of the Arms Sales Monitoring Project of the Federation of American Scientists. And if you're interested in finding out more about the Federation and about the areas in which it works, including things like terrorism and nuclear weapons, you can go to their website, www.fas.org. And Matt Schroeder, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks very much for having me.